As discussed by Dr. Matulonis, a key question being pursued in ongoing clinical trials is the potential role of the anti-VEGF agent bevacizumab, and I met with Dr. Robert Berger, who's the protocol chair of GOG-0218, a Phase 3 randomized study of carboplatin paclitaxel alone or with concurrent bevacizumab versus treatment with extended bevacizumab in patients with stage 3 or 4 ovarian cancer. Dr. Berger began our discussion by commenting on a Phase 2 study he previously reported looking at bevacizumab as monotherapy.
We observed in 62 patients with 1 to 2 prior cytotoxic regimens and measurable disease by RECIST criteria a 21% objective response rate and a 40% rate of progression-free survival at 6 months or greater in these patients. We looked at those two co-primary endpoints together because we didn't really know what to expect in terms of activity in the traditional sense. And so when the trial was designed, it was initially designed to look at progression-free survival rate at 6 months or greater as the primary endpoint. But we started to see patients clinically respond, and we saw objective tumor regression by imaging and exam in a number of these patients that wasn't expected. So the decision rule for proceeding to a second stage of accrual in that trial was based on actually seeing objective responses. So midway through the trial, we actually changed the objectives and made statistical adjustments to be able to look at the trial as having now two primary endpoints. It was very important to do that carefully so that we weren't jeopardizing the validity of the trial. In our own patients, we started to see a high proportion of patients with a prolonged stabilization of disease and resolution of symptoms, as well as resolution of malignant ascites and pleural effusions. The problem is we had no idea who these patients were. And when we did a regression analysis at the conclusion of the trial, factoring in all the variables that are known to be associated with disease progression in patients on phase 2 trials with traditional cytotoxic agents, such as number of prior regimens, the time from completion of initial therapy to first recurrence, age, performance status, all the traditional factors you think would predict the length of progression-free survival. None of those factors actually predicted the time to progression in patients treated with this drug. So it wasn't acting like a traditional cytotoxic therapy in that regard. So patients that were considered platinum resistant, which were about 45% or so, seemed to have the same ability to respond in terms of progression-free survival as patients that were considered platinum-sensitive.
I'm kind of curious, before you get into some more of the data, just personally, what it was like. You know, it's kind of interesting. You start out with a new agent. You really don't know what to expect.
Right.
Was there any patient that you saw that made you say, whoa, wait a second, something else might be going on here?
Well, yeah. One of the first patients we treated was a young woman who had stage 3C disease that was quite extensive. Even though she was optimally debulked surgically, she had multiple sites of residual disease and was entered onto a frontline trial where she was randomized to receive triple therapy, three cytotoxic drugs, gemcitabine, carboplatin, paclitaxel, for 8 cycles. And within 6 months of completing that regimen, she had extensive abdominal recurrence and actually a large pelvic recurrence associated with some bleeding from tumor invading through the upper vagina. So highly symptomatic recurrent disease, and she was one of the complete responders to Bev. So she received Bev, and within 2 months she had obvious tumor regression, was feeling better, was a student and back to school full time within a few months, and had a complete radiographic response and clinical response, and was disease-free for more than a year before having some signs of disease progression. What was interesting also, one of the interesting observations with this patient and with some of the others, is that when these patients began to show signs of disease progression after a response or prolonged stable disease. It seemed to be a very slow course of disease progression. And then when therapy was withdrawn, they seemed to have a very rapid progression of disease after withdrawal of therapy. So it looked like they were still benefiting from therapy with single agent Bev, even though they started to progress. And then at the time that the drug was withdrawn, they had a very rapid progression of disease. So it makes you think that maybe there could have been some benefit in continuing the drug, maybe in combination with another cytotoxic drug at the time of progression with Bev.
And of course, that's a huge area of controversy, particularly in colon cancer, where now we have some data from the Bright Tumor Registry. We have a prospective trial looking at that. I'm kind of curious, in this particular patient, what happened to her? Did you ever reintroduce Bev?
Well, this particular patient, she progressed so rapidly. The short answer is no. She received treatment with a third-line agent, which was a cytotoxic drug. Her intestinal tract became obstructed with multiple partial small bowel obstructions to the point where we felt that her risk of a GI perforation event was excessively high. There were other cytotoxic agents available to her that were acceptable according to NCCN guidelines that were introduced, but the fact of the matter is her disease progressed so rapidly that that process could not be reversed, and so we didn't feel it was safe. And there was no data on reintroduction of the drug.
Were there any tissue correlation studies or sera studies in your work?
Well, we actually, in the phase 2 GOG trial, we obtained tissue from the target lesion, which was flash frozen and stored. And then we obtained tissue from the same target lesion pre-cycle 4. We also had dynamic MRIs done at both of those time points, as well as serum and plasma samples at both of those time points. We evaluated traditional angiogenic biomarkers and actually just presented data at the SGO meeting, the Society of Gynecologic Oncologists meeting in Tampa within the last week. And what's been frustrating, as you know, is that we don't really have a good predictor of response to anti-VEGF therapy.
What about the issue of VEGF receptors on the tumor?
We didn't actually examine this issue, but I think it's an important area. We think that probably in ovarian cancers and other solid tumors, there are two things going on with VEGF receptors. One is related to functional VEGF receptor expression in tumor endothelium. And then there's also this issue of functional VEGF receptor expression in tumor cells themselves. So there are a number of preclinical studies, particularly in breast cancer, that have demonstrated that if you block VEGF receptor activity in vitro or in certain preclinical models, that you actually slow down tumor progression independent of endothelial cell activity. In some tumors, it may be that there's actually more than one thing going on, that you're, by neutralizing VEGF activity, by blocking specific receptors, you not only have an anti-endothelial effect and an anti-angiogenic effect, but you may have an intrinsic effect against the tumor directly, which is sort of an endothelial independent pathway. We did not examine that specifically in these ovarian cancers, but I think it would be important, especially in understanding why some of these tumors seem to be regressing as opposed to being maintained stable.
Going back to your study as well as the other paper that was presented at the same time, can you sort of compare and contrast what was seen in the two studies, both in terms of efficacy as well as side effects and toxicity?
Yeah, I mean, the GOG trial involved 62 patients with 1 to 2 prior regimens. It included patients with a full spectrum of prior treatment response. In other words, as I said before, about 40 to 50% of the patients had progressed within 6 months of receiving their most recent platinum-containing regimen, whereas the remainder had a platinum-free interval greater than that period of time. The single-agent BEV trial required that those patients be either primarily or secondarily platinum-resistant, and they could have received 2 to 3 prior regimens. So from the standpoint of risk of disease progression with any therapy, the Genentech trial patients were at higher risk.
What was seen in the two trials in terms of efficacy?
In the trial, which was terminated prematurely because of 5 GI perforations out of 44 patients, the objective response rate was 16% compared to the GOG trial where the response rate was 21%. And I think that the 6-month progression-free survival in the Genentech trial was lower than in the GOG trial. It may reflect the risk level of the patients in terms of what you would expect, but both trials still show single-agent activity.
And just to put that in context, how does the single-agent activity of bevacizumab in these two trials compare to single-agent activity previously with other agents, particularly chemotherapy in ovarian cancer?
Actually, very similar. It's hard to compare across phase two trials, but if you look at the drugs that have been moved forward into phase three testing, such as liposomal doxorubicin, GEM, and topotecan, very comparable in terms of response rates and progression-free survival rates at the median, or if you look at even 6-month progression-free survival. So on that basis, it would be considered an active drug that would be worthy of phase three investigation and potentially, you know, useful in managing patients with recurrent disease, although these trials were not meant up front to be used in application for FDA approval. It's possible that the data may be supportive in that regard. The toxicity differences are interesting. Again, it's hard to compare across trials, but as you know, the Genentech trial was closed prematurely due to these 5 GI perforation events, whereas the GOG trial had 0 GI perforation events. So that was a curious observation.
What do you think the explanation is?
There are several possibilities. Some of the events in the trial occurred remotely from completion of therapy. So several were in patients who had discontinued drug because of disease progression and now were in subsequent lines of therapy.
Well, that's interesting. So in other words, these did not all occur while the patient was on Bev?
That's right. Hmm. They still followed patients after they completed therapy for survival. And during that period of time, adverse events were reported, and these were attributed as possibly related to the drug. The risk level of the patients in terms of more heavily pretreated patients, patients with slightly worse performance status may have contributed to the difference. It's also possible that these patients had gastrointestinal manifestations of disease that were more significant. One of the things that was of concern was the possibility that intestinal wall involvement by tumor was a major factor, and it's very difficult to assess that other than histopathologically. If you try to do that with imaging, which was attempted in the Genentech trial, there was some blinded review of radiologic data that suggested that possibly bowel wall thickening on CT was a predictive factor, but that's not a conclusive finding. There's a suggestion. There are other investigators that have reported that pre-existing evidence of intestinal obstruction requiring parenteral support, whether it's parenteral hydration or nutrition, as well as intestinal decompression, is a risk factor. But again, I think prospective studies are needed to determine this, and we're trying to collect this data prospectively in the phase 3 placebo control trial, where we'll really have a more accurate estimate of what the key factors are. So in that trial, we're trying to do a regression analysis based on hypothetical risk factors for GI perforation in a prospective fashion. The beauty of having a placebo-controlled trial is that you eliminate the biases that may make an investigator more likely or less likely to investigate the possibility of a perforation when a patient presents with a variety of symptoms that could lead to an evaluation. It's almost safer to do it that way because there may be an intrinsic rate of GI perforation events in this disease population that we don't know about. And in fact, we know that there are patients on the phase 3 trial that have had GI perforation events that are not related to bevacizumab because they receive placebo. And so it will be very interesting to look at not only the rate of the incidence of this complication intrinsically in this population, but what the influence of Bev is and which patients seem to be at risk based on pre-existing medical conditions, environmental influences, other pharmacotherapies that are, you know, such as corticosteroid use. So we're evaluating all these factors prospectively in the phase 3 trial.
What other manifestations or side effects did you see? Hypertension, proteinuria, for example?
So hypertension, proteinuria are well-recognized side effects. In the GOG trial, the rate of grade 3 to 4 proteinuria was minimal. There was only one patient that happened to develop nephrotic syndrome, which reversed after discontinuation of the drug. And about 10% of patients had clinically relevant hypertension requiring antihypertensive therapy. There were no patients with arterial thrombotic events in that study. In the Genentech trial, there actually were no patients with grade 3 or 4 proteinuria, but there were a number of patients similar to the GOG trial with hypertension requiring therapy, and there were at least a couple of patients that had grade 3 or 4 arterial thrombotic events. The numbers are pretty small, so it's very hard to say, you know, that there's a significant difference in those events. The only one that really stood out as potentially important in terms of the differences in these patient populations was the GI perforation issue.
What other clinical research data do we have right now on Bev and ovarian cancer in addition to these two studies?
Well, there are a number of historical cohort studies that have been published, and those are basically several institutions' experience in using the drug off-label, both in a single-agent mode as well as with combination therapy, that have demonstrated clinical activity in much more heavily pretreated patient populations. These studies have also, in general, demonstrated maybe more significant risks of GI perforation, especially in patients that are more heavily pretreated and have received combination therapy with cytotoxic drugs. But again, those are uncontrolled studies. I think that they support two results seen in phase 2 trials that, you know, the drug has single agent disease stabilization properties, can induce some objective responses, is also effective with cytotoxic therapy, but probably more toxic in the setting of cytotoxic therapy for the management of recurrent disease. Difficult to know whether there's any additional benefit in patients receiving combination therapy versus single-agent therapy. There was also an important phase 2 study published recently in JCO by Dr. Augustin Garcia, which examined bevacizumab combined with metronomic or low-dose oral cyclophosphamide in patients very similar to the GOG-170D single-agent bevacizumab phase 2 trial, and demonstrated a slightly higher objective response rate and slightly higher 6-month progression-free survival rate than the single-agent Bev trial, suggesting the need for at least randomized phase 2 trials of bevacizumab plus either metronomic chemotherapy, other biological agents, or cytotoxic agents compared to bevacizumab alone or compared to those single agents alone.
Now, of course, bevacizumab doesn't have a current indication right now for ovarian cancer, but sort of putting that aside and looking in a clinical situation where a patient's not eligible for a clinical trial, and also putting aside the cost and reimbursement issue, just to sort of get into the pure science of clinical decision making. So if you remove all those factors, where do you think Bev really, based on the data we have right now, would fit in a patient who says to you, look, I want, you know, what you think is best for me, I'll pay for it, et cetera. Where do you think it would fit in?
I think based on all the data put together right now, what makes most sense is to consider bevacizumab as a single agent initially when administering it, and probably after patients have received what I would think would be the top tier second line therapies, and it could be fourth or fifth line.
How about first line?
I think in the absence of phase 3 data and not really understanding what the true risk of potentially life-threatening complications in a prospective phase 3 study, it's premature.
How about second line?
In second line, there's no evidence that whether any of these drugs are used second line, third line, fourth line, that the sequence of therapy ultimately affects survival or quality of life during that time period. I don't think anyone can say that sequence is important. I think, though, that we're really obligated in counseling our patients to first utilize probably FDA-approved standard second and third line therapies such as liposomal pegylated doxorubicin, topotecan, a platinum gem combination before utilizing single agent bevacizumab. I don't think it's entirely wrong to think about using it in the second and third line setting, but I just think we have to exercise some caution because we've got two phase 2 single agent trials. And since sequence doesn't seem to be as important, probably be more sensible just based on history and putting some value in the FDA approval process to utilize drugs that have been FDA approved at first and then going to a drug like bevacizumab immediately following that.
Now, you mentioned the issue before, like the patient you described who has a very dramatic response to bevacizumab, and the question of whether continuing it or adding a chemotherapeutic agent is something that would be a consideration. Again, non-protocol situation, is there any situation where you might do that?
Well, I think one of the things that is important to understand is that there are a number of patients, and we're looking at this now within the GOG phase 2 data set, there are a number of patients that demonstrate some evidence of progression, but more indolent progression, if you will, who have secondary responses while maintaining bevacizumab. And for example, it's not uncommon to have a patient in that situation be treated with the combination of continued bevacizumab with, let's say, low-dose oral cyclophosphamide based on the Garcia trial. And we've seen a number of patients with that regimen following single-agent Bev have secondary objective responses or disease stabilization for prolonged periods of time after initiating low-dose oral cyclophosphamide in patients that continue Bev. And there are other institutions that have reported anecdotally doing this with other agents such as weekly paclitaxel at low doses, platinum-containing regimens. We have some patients that have initiated single-agent platinum in the fourth, fifth, sixth line after showing some signs of progression with Bev alone, continued Bev and adding platinum after they haven't received a platinum-containing regimen for a year or two, who have had either responses or prolonged disease stabilization after introducing platinum in that setting. But I think we need to design trials to look at the question of continuing Bev versus discontinuing Bev, with having the common denominator being whatever that cytotoxic regimen is going to be following progression with a bevacizumab regimen, either single agent or in combination. So we need trials to look at maintaining anti-angiogenic therapy despite progression versus not, and looking at outcomes. That being said, one of the major issues we have with ovarian cancer in monitoring patients is the CA125 issue. That's something that I think a lot of people will be interested in looking at. Many clinical trials reflect what's in clinical practice, which is to utilize serum CA125 data to make decisions about whether a patient indeed has progressive disease. And traditionally, we think that this marker reflects disease status in some way. And in clinical practice, oncologists and patients tend to use CA125 data primarily in making decisions. In the absence of measurable disease, even in patients who are apparently clinically stable, have no evidence of disease progression by exam or by imaging, but have rising CA125 levels, many oncologists will discontinue current therapy and switch to another regimen. And I would definitely caution oncologists in doing this and patients treated with this drug, and it may be true of other drugs as well. But we have seen CA125 patterns in clinical practice that behave almost in a sawtooth pattern, where CA125 will kind of go up and down in such a way where on the way up you would be tempted to discontinue therapy, but we've been reluctant to do that. We've observed these patients and then re-imaged them and seen what looks like either stable disease or disease where there's a slight increase in the dimensions of target lesions that we've been following, but no evidence of other disease, and then seen subsequent regression of those areas with falls in CA125. And it's almost like having a star that's kind of flaring and then condensing. We see that in many patients that have prolonged disease stabilization despite these fluctuations in CA125. So I would definitely caution oncologists not to jump the gun in terms of discontinuing therapy just based on CA125, but at least establishing whether there's a trend in terms of clinical progression, or at least a convincing trend in CA125 before discontinuing therapy.
The last thing I want to ask you about is the issue of new agents and new strategies for ovarian cancer treatment. But just before we get into that, you mentioned second-line therapy and the various options that are available for that. Just kind of curious how you make those decisions in terms of what you use second, third, and fourth.
Well, this is a dilemma. We have now at least 10 or 12 active drugs that are being considered in these patients. And if you look at the 2008 NCCN guidelines for treatment, they're all listed as options that should be considered. How do you make that decision? We can't really say that one drug is better than another in any individual patient. Certainly, people have used drug resistance assays, the results of drug resistance assays, either on primary tumor to make decisions about second and third line therapy, or in some cases on tumor tissue retrieved immediately before that treatment decision is made to help guide therapy. It's not unreasonable to exclude drugs that appear to be ineffective in terms of demonstrating extreme resistance in drug resistance assays, and excluding those, at least initially, in favor of using drugs that did not appear to be ineffective. That's probably the most scientific way, but still unproven in terms of ultimately whether outcome is going to be effective. It's not unreasonable to do that. The other considerations, of course, are known toxicity, which is a lot more easily predictable in these patients. So the least toxic regimen, the most convenient regimen for patients, those two aspects should be considered foremost in the absence of other compelling data to know what sequence is most appropriate, where to start out. There are other factors that are probably used in the community to determine which regimens should be chosen, and some of those might be financial and economic, I don't know. And in our practice, which is essentially an academic practice, we tend to explore factors such as relative toxicity, impact on quality of life and activities of daily living, and convenience to the patient in selecting the sequence of second, third, fourth line therapy.
What about the issue of Bev plus intraperitoneal therapy?
Well, that's a very important question, because intraperitoneal chemotherapy is considered a standard option in patients with stage 3 ovarian cancer, especially those patients who have had an optimal cytoreductive surgery. There are 3 phase 3 trials which have demonstrated a survival advantage with intraperitoneal regimens in combination with some IV therapy compared to standard IV regimens. So it's important for us to establish the safety and efficacy of treating patients with these intraperitoneal cytotoxic regimens in combination of bevacizumab. There are some phase 1/feasibility trials that are being done now, and actually the anticipation is that there is a phase 3 trial that's currently under development to examine modified intraperitoneal cytotoxic therapy in patients with stage 3 optimally debulked ovarian cancer in combination with bevacizumab. So we're trying to establish efficacy and tolerability now, but I think the plan is, as long as those trials do not demonstrate unacceptable toxicity, that we will be seeing that in the context of IP therapy. I think it's important to also note that there's another phase 3 trial of bevacizumab in frontline therapy being conducted through the ICON group, which is ICON 7. There are several important differences between the frontline GOG trial and the ICON 7 trial. The most important difference is that it's a two-arm trial with arms that are similar to arm 1 of the GOG 218 trial, which is standard therapy, and then the second arm is concomitant plus extended bevacizumab, so it looks like arm 3 of GOG 218. The patient population is different in that all patients who require cytotoxic therapy, including patients with high-risk stage 1 disease, patients with stage 2 disease, through stage 4 disease, are eligible to enroll in ICON 7, whereas GOG 218 enrolls patients only with stage 3 and 4 disease. And ICON 7's primary endpoint is progression-free survival rather than overall survival. And the final difference is that the ICON 7 trial is not placebo-controlled, so it's completely open label.
What do you think your study in ovary is going to show with earlier disease?
Well, I think that the adjuvant trial is likely to demonstrate an advantage in the bevacizumab arm. Obviously, the number of patients needed to have sufficient power to demonstrate an advantage is going to be greater, and the timelines are going to be more extensive, but they're selecting fairly high-risk patients even in the adjuvant trial, so I would expect really to have a parallel result to their stage 4 trial. Based on the experience with other solid tumors, the phase 3 trials in non-small cell lung cancer, breast and colon cancer, and the intrinsic single-agent activity we've seen in the ovarian cancers and related diseases, I think that it would be likely that we would see a positive result in the GOG phase 3 trial and even in the ICON 7 trial. But if overall survival remains the primary endpoint in GOG 218, we may only see a progression-free survival advantage and not an overall survival advantage because of the issue of patients receiving what's felt to be an active drug, meaning bevacizumab. If it's as active as we think, then the overall survival advantage may be neutralized in patients receiving the drug in subsequent lines of therapy. It remains to be seen. I don't want to jinx the trial, but I think you would expect to see at least a progression-free survival advantage. One of the things that we still have not established as well is if the concomitant use of cytotoxic therapy with Bev increases the risk of GI perforation. One of the initial designs of the current phase 3 trial was a 2x2 design where Bev was actually withheld during the cytotoxic therapy phase. So the initial design was a randomization to Bev versus no Bev during the cytotoxic phase, which is phase A, and then in the extension phase, another randomization, so that potentially, 25% of the patients would have received Bev only in the phase B at the conclusion of cytotoxic therapy. It would have been very interesting to look at all of these outcomes, including GI perforation rate, which you would think would be lower in patients receiving Bev in the extension phase only than in patients receiving it during the cytotoxic phase as well.